Want to bring a third person into the therapy session, you can do so, but use an informed consent form. And the informed consent form should say that you are coming in to assist in the therapy of the patient, name the patient. You are not the patient, and by your appearance here, the doctor is undertaking no duty and no responsibility to you. If the person will not come in under those circumstances, do not bring them in. That will protect you from third-party liability. In terms of liability to patients, the problem is difficult because a lot of the stories you're hearing are unbelievable. Not unbelievable in the sense that they're physically impossible, but unbelievable in the sense that people do not want to know that these things happen, and they are willing to believe that these things do not happen. The false memory people, in what I call the false logic of false memory, commit an error of science when they lump together multiple personality disorder, satanic cults, mind control programming, green programming, etc., etc. It is important that all of those things be separated out. The DSM-4, as some of its predecessors, entitles therapists to diagnose a condition of multiple personality disorder, or now dissociative identity disorder.
We are in the middle of listening to a lecture by Dr. Alan Shefflin, Walter Bowert, and Randy Noblett that was given in Texas at a conference of cult abuse, trauma, and dissociation. This is part of the series on mind control here at CKLN on the International Connection. And this particular lecture, I hope, gives a little bit of insight into some of the issues around therapy for survivors of mind control and ritual abuse. Stay tuned now for part two.
Dissociative identity disorder. You have the right to do that. It is a recognized psychiatric phenomenon. And though the false memory people may not like it, it empowers therapists to diagnose people as having that condition. And so if you do so, the fact that you have used that diagnosis is not sufficient to make you legally liable. Even if you are wrong in a particular case as to whether a person is a multiple, that in and of itself will not necessarily make you liable to a patient, as long as you have done your work conscientiously and you really believe that that was an appropriate diagnosis. It is very helpful to network with people, to get second opinions, in other words, to diffuse the responsibility among other professionals, to show that you have done everything possible to make sure that the judgment that you passed on that patient was as clinically accurate and correct as it could be. In that context, when we move to satanic ritual abuse, we do not find anything in the DSM-4, and we do not find anything on mind control programming either. And so these are tougher grounds. They're harder to defend, and they're much more difficult to face in courts of law. How do you handle them? It is a general rule of therapy that you will do better as a therapist for your patient if you believe the patient or give the appearance of believing the patient. A good deal of therapy, as all of the studies are showing, has to do with the relationship and not the theories used by the therapist. It is the relationship of trust and confidence and authenticity that is paramount in the healing process. And so if a patient comes in and says, I'm an eggplant, you should believe that that person is an eggplant for the purpose of sitting in that room. And you can give advice to stay out of kitchens, to stay away from knives. You are well within your rights to take whatever presenting conditions come in and work with it at that level. That you get more by accepting what people tell you than you do by arguing that they must be crazy and they must be wrong. And I think this is one of the essential points that's missed by the false memory people, because they don't do clinical work, and their scientific board, for the most part, doesn't do clinical work either. That no matter how strange the presenting ideas, you will do better clinically by working with them as if they are real than to try to resist them and talk your patients out of them. Now, as to whether you believe what they are telling you or not, that's up to you. And that's not something that should be the basis of a lawsuit against you. But how you work with the patient is a fiduciary responsibility. It requires you to act in the patient's best interests, which means to give the patient that sense of sincere belief, even if you don't have it. Now, the unfortunate thing is that there are many crazy stories that we have heard that we've been able to validate. I'm thinking of the Jim Thornwell case in particular, where one day some lawyers in Oakland called me and said, we've got some crazy guy here talking about mind control and shootouts with the French police and truth serums and hypnosis and whatever. We don't have any idea what he's talking about. Why don't you come over and see if you can make any sense out of it? So I went over there and I spent a few hours with him, and he told me this incredible story about being in Orléans, France, and having working in a NATO facility. There were some secret documents that were missing, and suspicion focused on him. They asked if they could hypnotize him. He said yes. Could they use a polygraph? Yes. Could they use a truth serum? Yes. None of that showed him to be guilty, but the officer still decided he must have been the one to have taken those documents. And so they staged a shootout with the French police. They're driving along, and a French police car pulls up, squeals to a halt. The doors open. The officers come out, start firing at the car in which Jim Thornwell is riding, and that car squeals away to get out of the gunfire. Then that did not faze Thornwell. They could not get him to confess because he said, I'm innocent. They then told his fellow barracks members that he was having sexual relations with their wives. And so when they released him back to the barracks, he wound up getting in a lot of fistfights. So they kindly agreed to put him under protective custody for his own good, took him to a mill, and gave him LSD. Of course, he didn't know what LSD was at the time. Almost nobody knew what it was at the time. And he said that he was sitting down, and the next thing he knew, he was off in a corner baying like an animal, his head exploding into 1,000 galaxies, and people saying to him, did you take the documents? Did you take the documents? And the experience was so destructive to him that he never did get to put his life together. And even after Congress threw a special bill, which is almost impossible to get, awarded him about $500,000, he never got to enjoy that because he was found dead under mysterious circumstances shortly thereafter. It turned out that everything that Jim Thornwell told me, and I have it all on tape, was accurate. As bizarre as the story may sound, we wrote to the Army, we got 3,000 pages of documents, and one of them said, we're not going to court-martial this man because his memory is too good, and we don't want this on the public record. And everything that he had told us was validated. We turned the story over to 60 Minutes, they did it, and then CBS did a film based on his life. So no matter how strange the story you hear, the patient is at least entitled to the presumption of some truth in it. And you must work with that some truth. The false memory argument that I accept is that therapists have been unfamiliar with a literature on suggestion and social influence, and in fact are implanting the memories rather than recovering them. I've had enough experience testifying in courts to know that the false memory people have correctly identified a problem. A problem that could have been solved by now had they not been vicious in the way in which they sought their own solutions. But the false memory argument that therapists are implanting memories leads to a development that you need to know about. Because I think it is the next step in therapy, and it's not inconsistent with what you've heard from the prior two speakers. There has never been a reason in your training why you should have to read police interrogation manuals, the brainwashing literature, the literature on suggestion, the literature on persuasion and social influence, but that time has now come. You are, in essence, being accused by the false memory people of not being familiar with the basic currency in which your profession traffics, and that is manipulating people. Interestingly enough, I accept the argument of the false memory people, but I reject their conclusion. The false memory people argue that therapy is in fact persuasion or manipulation, and that's what's wrong with it. I argue that's what's right with it, and that what we have to do is to recognize that, yes, there is in the therapy setting a relationship that is disproportionate in terms of power, in which one person is stronger and more knowledgeable and another person is more dependent. And the job in that relationship is for the person who is more powerful to change by consent the person who is more dependent. The patient comes to you and doesn't say, "I like the way I am, let's just sit around and talk." The patient comes and says, "Change me," and the false memory people now want to sue you for doing it. I think they've missed the point. I think, yes, it is true that you have not been aware of the suggestion literature and the social influence literature and the police interrogation literature, and that you will have to know that literature now because there's a new standard of care for practicing therapy emerging. And in the ultimate conclusion of what the false memory people are saying is to up the ante on the kind of training therapists will have to have. But that's simply going to put on the table the one question that therapy has been avoiding all of this century, and that is the ethics of manipulating people. And with the recognition that you are in a social influence relationship when you are with a patient, then your job is to do it well and to use the techniques that are available to you, not to hurt the patient and not to mind control the patient, but to allow the patient to change, usually outside of the conscious awareness of the patient, in a way that that change can be therapeutic. And to do that, you must know the social influence literature. And so for some people on the false memory board, they point a finger at you and they say, "You see, you're a mini cult. The relationship between a therapist and a patient is like the relationship between a cult leader and a follower." And then they say, "Well, actually, you know, you're like a police officer doing an interrogation." Because the same principles apply in both settings, both social influence settings. And so they see you as mini cults and mini police interrogation stations and accuse you of using techniques of social influence. I argue that they are right to point out that these are social influence settings, but they cannot point to any setting which is not social influence based. Anytime two people interact with one another, the laws of social influence apply. And your job is not to get rid of the social influence aspect of doing therapy, but rather to do it better and make sure you do it in ways that are consistent with your fiduciary responsibility to the patient. And in the long run, when the false memory people go away, what will happen is that you will have learned the laws of suggestion, the laws of police interrogation, all the things that we'll be talking about during the next couple of days, and that eventually it will be part of the basic training in therapy schools for people to be familiar with this literature. And in that sense, and I think an odd thing has happened. In the 1970s, when we were working on our books, mind control was this demon, and the government had played with it, and we're trying to wrest those files from the government control. Really, what we're trying to do is to tame mind control and find ways for it to work for everybody's betterment. And if we can accomplish that, then we'll be twice blessed. We would have solved the problem we started in the 70s, and we would have eliminated the unfair condemnation of the false memory movement. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank the speakers. I also have, those of you who know me, know I'm going to have 2 cents to add. So some of you may be wondering, though, at this point, okay, mind control, what does that have to do with cults? Since that word is associated with the topic for this conference. I wonder how many people out there think that there are groups, cults, whatever, where they practice, let's say, harmful, deviant, black magic, Satanism, not witchcraft in the sense of Wicca, but dark arts, so to speak. I wonder how many people think that. And some of you might be wondering, what is the connection between cults, witchcraft, Satanism, so on, and the mind control that you're going to be hearing a great deal about from the finest experts on that subject here. And that's an important point. And I'm hoping that if we accomplish one thing in this conference, it is that we get a clear sense about what is the connection, because there is a connection. First of all, when we think about what people are calling satanic cults, many of you are aware that the false memory syndrome folks are arguing this is entirely a fantasy concept. You know, it has no basis in reality, that people stay up too late and watch late night TV, and they go see a therapist who's fanatical. And I had such a patient. Actually, I've seen about 200. This is a garment. This is a garment that her false memories conjured up in her attic. I'm not sure how her false memories did it, but here it is. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about this robe because it has an interesting story associated with it. It was brought to me by a patient who found it in her residence. She dissociated and was able to explain what it meant and what it was about, but in her waking normal state, she was shocked and horrified that she found this in her residence. She didn't, in fact, she had there was a part of the garment that she didn't even know what it was. And we'll be talking more about that later. It was found in a box with roses, dried roses, very old, and a newspaper that's 20 years old that apparently was just used for packing purposes. So it's amazing what these false memories can produce out of nothing. But anyway, we need to start thinking about what is the common thread that goes through all this. And actually, there is a common thread, and it goes back even further historically than Satanism, or what people call Satanism. I say that, I qualify that, because I don't believe that everybody who puts on a black robe is a Satanist. I think there are times that fraternities do stunts like that. And in fact, I think our previous president, Bush, wasn't he a member of a group called the Skull and Bones? And I think they put on things like this. Of course, that doesn't seem to disprove you all, but I'm trying my best. Anyway, maybe I should have taken a different kind of logic there. But actually, this is an old story, and it's a story of trauma. It's a story of slavery. It's a story of the complete annihilation of other human beings when you can get away with it. It's a very, very sad story, and has a long history. We can hear about that story and read about it in old documents, such as the Bible. The Bible talks about children passing through the fire. It talks about horrible things happening. And, of course, many people may have just thought, well, that's kind of an interesting story. You know, what does it mean? What does it mean that Aztecs and that other Mesoamericans would flay people on an altar and consume their heart? What's that all about? Well, my argument is there's a thread that goes all through this. And if we want to go back in time, we can go all the way back to the worship of nature, shamanism, and so on. Trauma has always been viewed throughout history as a way of creating altered states of consciousness. Trauma, there are a variety of ways to create altered states of consciousness. Obviously, you can meditate. You can do hypnosis. You can listen to drums pounding, and they'll kind of carry you off, and you'll drift a little bit. But nothing really exciting happens. Nothing very impressive happens. It's my belief that many, many years ago, people learned that if you traumatize a person in a certain way, you can create the God that you worship. And so for that reason, many early religions, many very old religions, included trauma in their worship. In fact, there's a book out, some of you may have seen it, it's called God is a Trauma. And it's about, particularly about some of the Gnostic traumatic practices that went back into ancient times. But we can carry this back even further than, say, the ancient times, ancient medieval times, back to, again, shamanism. Now, it's hard really to understand shamanism in detail now, the ancient version, because, again, many of these practices are pre-literate. We have no way to know exactly what people did. We just see these examples, for example, in the Mayan temples, and we know that these buildings were probably used for these purposes. But it's a little easier to understand it if we look into the shamanistic practices of modern times. For example, I wonder how many people here are familiar with the sun gazing dance, or the sun dance, as it's called. Some of you are, okay. Well, this is still practiced in North America. Some of you may have seen the movie that came out some, 20 years ago, Man Called Horse. And in the movie, I thought it was totally fictional, because I didn't think you could ever get anybody who would agree to be lifted up but with hooks stuck in their pectoral muscles. I didn't figure a big line would establish with people waiting to do that. But I assumed it was totally fictional. But as it turns out, I was doing some reading on shamanism, and I read a modern-day account, and I saw photographs of them doing the sun dance now, the sun-gazing dance. And again, the idea is very simple. I'll be talking about this more when I get into more programming in particular. To me, this is where programming begins, where people perhaps learned accidentally that the use of trauma and other kinds of ritual acts can produce dissociated states, can produce dissociated identities. That is, you can produce the deity. And many villages may have wanted to have their deity there, and it may have been a great honor for some child to go through these horrible procedures so that the village could have their deity right there with them. Well, through time, these practices passed through some changes, but not a whole lot. Many of you are probably aware of the mystery cults that existed around the Mediterranean during the ancient and up until the medieval times. Many of these involved traumatic rituals as well. And so now we have many people making allegations that some of the modern day remnants of these mystery cults, that is the fraternal organizations of modern times, engage in this kind of behavior as well. There are also many other pre-industrial cults. There's an excellent book by Oki, an African Juju high priest, who writes about the traumatic ordeals that were used in his West African community on people, and he describes the dissociation that also occurs there. So these things are happening now. Now, some of you may wonder, though, okay, this makes sense, it's logical, and somewhere in there, Satanism is a part, too. We hear so much about Satanism. Certainly, there must be some, where the smoke, there's got to be something to that. So where's the connection with the U.S. government and other governments and CIA and military intelligence? Doesn't this really sound awfully far-fetched? Well, we can go back to the Hellfire Clubs of England and Ireland in the 1700s, and we see a very clear connection there between governments, powerful members of governments, and bizarre occult or satanic, whatever you want to call it, dark kinds of activities. As many of you probably know, Ben Franklin was a visitor of the Hellfire Club in London, or outside of London, and additionally, the organization established in the outskirts of London was actually created by Sir Francis Dashwood, who shortly thereafter became the Chancellor of the Exchequer of Great Britain. In other words, he would be the equivalent of the Secretary of the Treasury. We're talking about top-level government. He was a personal friend to George III. Very high-level government type individual. And this was an individual who was carrying on in his residence bizarre practices that included blasphemous religious acts, bizarre sexual acts, and so on. Well, this is where we see a rather obvious beginning connection between governments and bizarre occult and other kinds of procedures like that. Aleister Crowley is another individual where we see a very clear connection between occultism, possibly Satanism, and governments. Crowley, of course, was involved with the British intelligence, as many of you know. And from then, we have this marriage made in hell, so to speak. In any case, there is a clear connection between the use of trauma in a ritualized manner and the development of dissociated individuals, the individuals that are coming forth that we're seeing nowadays clinically. And hopefully, I'm hoping that in this particular conference, we'll be able to show that connection, how it is, how it works, and hopefully give an opportunity for, we have many survivors who will be here telling their stories. We also will have some mothers who are protective mothers who are doing their best to try to protect children in extremely abusive environments. And they're finding out that the government, who is supposed to protect them, is doing just the opposite. We'll have time to talk about that as well. This is one of the great tragedies, is that something horrible is going on, but the people that we all should be able to trust to help us don't seem to be doing their job. And that is why it is my belief that we must have a citizens' movement to correct this terrible wrong. Now, you may wonder, what good can people do, just individual people? Those of you who may be familiar with the history of the mafia may know that the... maybe I should ask. Do any of you believe the mafia exists? One person over there, okay. Did you know that there was a group that came out that said the mafia did not exist? And in fact, they persuaded the governor of New York at that time to become a member. They affected the production of The Godfather, so they took the word mafia out. And in fact, I have to admit that for a long time, I didn't know if there was such a thing as a mafia. I didn't use that word out of respect to Italian Americans. I still do respect Italian Americans, but I know that the mafia does exist because in 1989, the FBI did finally get a tape, an audio tape of a mafia initiation ceremony. Anyway, this organization trying to protect Italians eventually did succeed in convincing many people that the mafia did not exist. In fact, it does exist. Well, the interesting thing, though, I'm going about this in a very circuitous way. Many of you know that the mafia did not first start in New York. That was not really where it first got started. I think there's an excellent parallel here between the mafia and these various agencies of the government and individuals practicing these deviant acts, because the bottom line is they're engaging in criminal behavior, organized crime. It's a kind of organized crime. And we know that our government is capable of engaging in organized crime. We're learning that more and more all the time. But the mafia, since it did begin in New Orleans, it was first operative in New Orleans, was very successful. And there were some cases that came up where people complained, and there were efforts to prosecute mafiosi, but they were entirely unsuccessful. Aren't you all amazed that the local government was unable to effectively prosecute the mafiosi in the late 1800s in New Orleans? This comes as a shock to many of you, I understand. But the mafia were essentially driven out of New Orleans. Not entirely, obviously. I don't think you can ever totally eliminate, and I'm sure they're back there now. But how was it done? It was done by a citizens' movement, by a grassroots group of people who decided they were not going to have this in their community anymore. So it is my belief that if we truly want to see this kind of horror stop, it is something that we as citizens, we as human beings, will have to make that commitment to. And I'm hoping that that our organization in part, and the other, you've heard about other organizations here looking toward that same goal, that as we join together as a whole, we will be successful in this endeavor. And then
we've been listening to a lecture by Randy Noblett, Walter Boart, and Dr. Alan Shufflin. And you've been listening to The International Connection here on CKLN 88.1. Stay tuned next week, and we're going to feature the next 2 weeks a lecture about the history of mind control, what we know and what we don't, by Dr. Alan Shufflin. You're listening to 88.1. Coming up next is Aquí Nuestra America. And just a quick announcement, there is an event to commemorate the 12th anniversary of the bombing of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia. This is happening Friday, May 16th at 7 p.m. in Center 276. That's 276 Augusta, just south of College. And there'll be video, news updates, and a discussion brought to you by Friends of MOVE and Bulldozer Prison News Service.